continued to rage in West Africa, where nearly 10,000 have been infected. So naturally, in the United States, wall-to-wall coverage fixated on the United States. No wonder, including patient number one, the late Thomas Eric Duncan, who arrived from Liberia infected, two nurses whom he infected, and the New York doctor just returned ill from Guinea, the total of cases diagnosed in this country has skyrocketed to 4.
And tonight, Ebola has come roaring back into the news. All it took was a suspected case in the nation's largest population center, New York City.
Without a travel ban, travelers with undiagnosed cases of Ebola can appear in our emergency rooms.
The World Health Organization says it missed the writing on the wall with Ebola, but now that the virus is hopping across the globe, is it too late to stop it?
My brother is a critical care doctor. He would tell you right off the bat, this thing is easier to get than you believe.
No, it isn't. Which may explain why the cases of Ebola transmission in this country are confined to healthcare workers who were in direct physical contact with a dying patient exhibiting full-blown symptoms, as opposed to, say, anyone who may have encountered the infected travelers on a plane or subway before they were symptomatic, or anyone else in Dallas or New York, or you. The threat to the U.S. public is infinitesimal, but the hysteria is full-blown.
Even a school teacher's trip to Dallas was enough to cause a panic in Maine.
Last night, workers disinfected a Cleveland school because a teacher may have had contact with an Ebola patient.
Syracuse University canceled an appearance by Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Michael Duseal because he was in Liberia 3 weeks ago.
Watching this unfold, you can draw two different conclusions about the news media as an institution. One possibility is that we've simply not figured out how to balance the public's right to know against the danger of shouting fire in a crowded theater. The other is that we're too financially dependent on the audiences we generate to slow down when reporting mutates into fear-mongering. Either way, the national hyperventilation became so severe in the last 2 weeks that Fox News Channel's Shepard Smith tried to call a timeout.
These are the facts. We do not have an outbreak of Ebola in the United States, nowhere. Suggestions have been made publicly that leaders and medical professionals may be lying to us. Those suggestions are completely without basis in fact.
Smith went on to dispense the smartest public health advice of the week, get a flu shot. Bless his heart. Although, of course, the rest of Fox News was pretty much hysteria ground zero.
Meanwhile, we have a border that is so porous, Ebola or ISIS or Ebola on the backs of ISIS could come through our border.
In fact, throughout the U.S. media last week, unlike the physical nation, Ebola was rampant. The story dominated every front page, and according to the Tyndall Report, in the past 3 weeks, consumed 28% of the big three networks' combined news holes, 239 minutes of coverage on ABC, CBS, and NBC. And of those 239 minutes, exactly 28 were devoted to West Africa, where the epidemic actually resides. And so, for the listener seeking a template for simple perspective, On the Media presents the Breaking News Consumer Handbook, Infectious Disease Edition. Item number one. Pathogen outbreaks are like shootings. The early reports will be frantic, decontextualized, and at least half wrong.
All right, so the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, are confirming the first Ebola case that's been diagnosed in the United States. They do not go into detail about where...
When the patient first presented in Dallas, most of the stories forgot to include the information that... Oh, Ebola is only contagious through bodily fluids, right? It's not an airborne disease.
Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute. When the alarms begin, she says, the public needs to resist the impulse to stampede in terror.
Ask who is shouting fire and how far away the fire is and how hot is the flame and which way is the wind blowing. And that's a lot to ask of the news consumer. But the consumer has to develop a new set of skills.
Item number two, noise level is not a measure of risk level. So don't let the sheer volume become the message.
To the extent that there is factual information and useful information in there, it may simply get overwhelmed.
Rutgers University political scientist David Redlosk directs the Rutgers Eagleton poll, where researchers quantified how Ebola news overconsumption yielded undercomprehension.
We asked, how easy is it to transmit Ebola from a sick person? And 36% thought it was very easy, while 31% thought somewhat easy, when the correct answer really is not very easy at all.
That statistic was demoralizing, but not as demoralizing as the result when heavy consumers of the Ebola story were polled.
Nearly half of them thought Ebola was very easy to transmit.
Item number three. On cable TV and Twitter, breaking news usually isn't. More likely, it's incremental and superfluous. Turn off push notifications to avoid the noise. Item number four, if the CDC says worry, worry. Take precautions. If the CDC says don't worry, don't worry, even if they themselves seem a bit overwhelmed.
In our age of 24-hour news and Twitter and so on, it's very hard for anyone in government to display a learning curve without being accused of incompetence.
Laurie Garrett is Senior Fellow for Global Health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Earlier this month, she published a Washington Post op-ed debunking Ebola's five biggest myths. She also cautions against cherry-picking news reports for details that validate primal fears.
I think that the fear of new microbes is visceral. It's in our DNA. It probably has protected humans for millennia from walking right into the next village over and getting themselves exposed to something that was circulating in that village. It's nutty when you get to the vaccine era, the antibiotic era, and the age of jet travel, because we still find that very easily that visceral response can be tapped into and manipulated by political forces, by individuals who claim some great conspiracy theory.
Or by your own inner panic button. Hence, item number five, your worst fears are a poor touchstone. Don't filter out information that discredits them. Pay close attention to sentences that begin with but. They often can be translated as never mind. Item number six, Hollywood is pretend.
On day one, there were two people, and then four, and then 16. In 3 months, it's a billion. That's where we're headed.
They're calling out the National Guard. They're moving the president underground.
People will panic.
Hollywood is pretend. Hollywood is pretend. That clip, which we trot out for the second time this month, is from the 2011 disaster thriller Contagion. As much as it resembled CNN yesterday, it is not a documentary. Watching movies to learn about medicine is like reading the Congressional Record to learn about dance. On the subject of considering the source, please note that last week R&B singer Chris Brown tweeted to his 13.5 million followers his suspicion that Ebola is a population control conspiracy. Aha! Item number seven. Pay no attention to what any celebrity thinks about science, medicine, or public health. Brown and Jenny McCarthy are fools. Madonna once told Oprah that yoga changes the molecular structure of your body. It doesn't. Public idiocy, of course, is not confined to celebrities. We also have politicians for that, including cynics and demagogues who exploit unreasonable fears for electoral ends. And they know the public's soft spots. Pointer's Kelly McBride.
Be aware of the xenophobic overtones or the racial overtones that can infect the attitudes in the United States. We're not condemning anybody, but there are elements of race and xenophobia in our fear. And I think we would be foolish to ignore our own history of racism and xenophobia and suggest that we're completely over that.
And because yapping politicians make news, item number eight. Within 2 weeks of an outbreak, posturing congressmen will call for borders to be closed. ignored them. This has nothing to do with epidemiology and everything to do with nationalist politics. To conclude, and this really does sum up everything, we turn once again to Fox's Shepard Smith.
Someday, something may start spreading that they can't control. And then, you know what we're going to have to do? We're going to have to relax and listen to leaders. We're not going to panic when we're supposed to, and we're certainly not going to panic now. We have to stop it.
Yes, beware of the wolf, but be sure you can have trust in your shepherd. The Breaking News Consumer's Handbook, Infectious Disease Edition, download it at onthemedia.org. Coming up, money in politics is corrupting and hard to trace, but the portions are so large. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Moo.com, an online print and design company providing software and tools to create business cards, flyers, and triple-thick luxe cards. More at Moo.com. This is NPR.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. A new documentary looks at the rise of the hardest working man in show business, James Brown. What was it like to work with him?
You know, if you was in the James Brown band, you could look to rehearse for hours and hours until you dropped, you know.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Urbana-Champaign, on the corner of Green and Birch in Urbana, where progressive religion has had a home for more than 150 years. More information is on the web at uucuc.org or visit on Sunday mornings before services.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. November 4th is midterm election day. Like you care. A recent Pew poll found that just 15% of Americans say they're following the midterm elections very closely. It is, however, slated to be the most expensive midterm ever, costing a projected $4 billion, much of it on TV advertising. Super PACs and 501c4s are some of the biggest spenders on political ads, boosting or smearing would-be legislators, mayors, and governors. But judges are also on the campaign finance gravy train. 90% of state judges must face voters at some point. And Emory University law professor Joanna Shepherd says the cash flowing to influence the election of state jurists has soared, especially since the 2010 Citizens United ruling opened the floodgates on independent political expenditures.
In the 2001-2002 cycle, independent spending was about $2.7 million, whereas in the most recent election cycle, 2011-2012, this number was $24.1 million. So that is a tenfold increase over the decade.
Shepherd is the co-author of a new study from Emory and the American Constitution Society that found that ads produced to influence judicial elections are designed to press the voters' hottest buttons.
Most voters don't really care about a lot of the technical, you know, somebody breached a contract, somebody didn't perform this the way they were supposed to. But what they do care about are ads about the way judges voted in specific criminal cases.
And it might sound a little something like this.
When child molesters sued to stop electronic monitoring of their locations, a law that let us track child molesters near schools, playgrounds, daycare centers, Supreme Court Justice Robin Hudson sided with the predators. Hudson cited a child molester's right to privacy and took the side of the convicted molesters. Justice Robin Hudson, not tough on child molesters, not fair to victims.
Do the facts of this case actually support the allegation in the ad?
No, they don't. There was a new law in North Carolina that said that people who had been convicted of child molesters could be monitored electronically. The problem was that the law, as written, could be construed as applying to people previously convicted. And so that means that it was instituting a retroactive punishment. And although that may sound good, that is actually unconstitutional in the United States to pass a new law that applies retroactively. And so Hudson's call was really based on her interpretation of the Constitution, certainly not her support for child molesters or anything else.
But who did fund it?
This ad was funded by a conservative group that in the past has received money from the Koch brothers, the Justice for All North Carolina Super PAC.
Ah, the Koch brothers. So it's one thing to establish that the PACs have an agenda beyond, let's say, softness on crime, that they have political and economic motivations for unseating an incumbent. That's one set of problems. The other set of problems is if incumbents actually change their behavior on the bench in order to protect themselves in subsequent elections. How do you go about ascertaining if that's going on?
Over the years, there's been various surveys that ask judges what are the influences on the way they make decisions on the bench. And in several of these surveys, which are anonymous, the judges have indicated that money does seem to matter. For example, 46% of judges believe that campaign contributions have at least some influence on their decisions. I worked with a team of independent researchers at Emory University to code data from criminal appeals cases in the state Supreme Court of 32 states from 2008 to 2013 to see if there was an empirical link between the money, the TV ads, the recent ruling in Citizens United, and the way judges are ruling in these criminal cases.
And you discovered, sure enough, there is a correlation.
Yes, we found that the more TV ads aired during state Supreme Court judicial elections, the less likely justices are to vote in favor of criminal defendants. We consider a vote in favor of the criminal defendant to be any vote that betters the criminal's position at all from the position that they were in prior to appealing their case to the Supreme Court.
And can you quantify the margin pre-Citizens United to post-Citizens United?
Prior to Citizens United, in the states that had bans on independent spending, we found that judges were about 7% more likely to vote in favor of criminal defendants than they were after Citizens United, when the bans on independent spending were eliminated and hence unleashed unlimited corporate and union independent expenditures, which are some of the primary sources of funding for TV ads.
On the subject of bias, the American Constitution Society is not a neutral player in this case. It's a think tank with an advocacy role, and it's a progressive organization coming from the political left. Should that influence how I interpret your research results?
I worked with the American Constitution Society in gathering this data, but I am a professor at Emory University Law School. The data collection process is very expensive. So with ACS's interest in these issues, it enabled us to fund coding of the cases, but ACS was in no way involved in choosing the researchers, choosing how I directed the study or anything like that.
The results you've shared with us today are horrifying, not in any way surprising. Now that we have statistical evidence that outside money is being used not only to influence elections, but also actual performance of duties by elected officials, what are we supposed to do with it?
Well, I think that it really distorts the role of the judiciary from a neutral interpreter of the law to something that's more political by nature. Currently, the states are split on whether or not individual judges can ask for financial contributions directly to contributors. And there's a new case pending before the Supreme Court this year, Linnell Williams U. Lee versus the Florida Bar, which will ask whether state bans on judges individually soliciting campaign contributions are constitutional or not. And obviously, that's a big issue. I mean, the implications of our study and other studies in the past suggest that money is influencing case outcomes. And so if judges are able to directly solicit money, that will potentially make the problem significantly worse.
There was a time when the judiciary was mainly appointed, and society has come around to a different way of thinking. Do your data suggest that we had it right in the first place?
Yeah, well, the original 13 colonies were a point of, and it was during the Jacksonian era where elections were heralded as protecting our government officials from any sort of undue influence. When the states were considering a switch to elections, they did not anticipate how much money would be raised in these races, how political they would become. There's a quote from a union organizer who's been involved in campaigning in these judicial elections, who says, "We figured out a long time ago that it's easier to elect seven justices than 132 legislators." And that's essentially what's going on. We can influence which laws are passed, or we can influence how those laws are interpreted or whether or not they're upheld once they reach the Supreme Court. And it's, you know, money well spent.
Joanna, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Joanna Shepherd is co-author of Skewed Justice, Citizens United, Television Advertising, and the State Supreme Court Justices' Decisions in Criminal Cases, a new study from Emory University and the American Constitution Society. Between Congressional Intransigence and Citizens United, advocates for transparency in campaign finance could be forgiven for being, hopeless. This year, a vast percentage of midterm election spending will be in so-called dark money, untraceable because it comes from 501c4 organizations supposedly dedicated to social welfare, like the social welfare promoted here.
So why is Terry Lynn Land still ignoring the science? She's got her reasons, over 6 million of them, from the Koch brothers front groups backing her campaign.
Who bankrolled that ad? There's no way to know, since the organization that paid for it, dubbing itself the League of Conservation Voters, doesn't have to tell us. But Yale University law professor Heather Gerken has a plan that would turn vice into virtue, using the very darkness of dark money to cast a shadow of doubt on the message. Heather, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, of course, it seems to me that the 501c4s are themselves transparently not the social activists they claim to be, but just conduits for political money. You're suggesting, though, rather than try to campaign for regulations against 501c4s within the bounds of Citizens United, I should concentrate on the message itself. What's the gimmick?
So the trick here is that for a long time, the FEC and Congress have tried to regulate the organization. And it has been a failure because new kinds of organizations spring up every time. The 501c4s are just the latest. The proposal that Wade Gibson and Webb Lyons and I came up with is to regulate the ad, not the organization. At the end of an ad that is paid for by dark money, it will simply state that this ad was funded by an organization that does not disclose all of its donors. It's clean, it's clear, it gives voters the information they need, and it's truthful.
Won't the 501c4s and others in the political lucre business say, you can't put words in our mouth? Won't they claim that it's a violation of their free speech?
Well, they might say that, but then they're going to have to consult Citizens United, which, although it's much loathed by reformers, there is a part of Citizens United that got 8 of the 9 justices' votes, and it was the one that said that it is constitutional to require disclaimers and disclosures on political advertisements because, Justice Kennedy said, the First Amendment has an interest in citizens knowing the source of information. So this is no different than what has been pronounced constitutional already, which is called the stand by your ad rule. And the stand by your ad rule requires a politician, you know, that little moment at the end where they say, I paid for this message. If politicians can be forced to stand by their ad, then surely the dark money organizations can be forced to acknowledge that they are not standing by their ad.
Forgive me for playing devil's advocate, but let's just say that you were to prevail. Won't they come right back and just disclose, let's say, the name of 2 or 3 or 50 of their donors, keep all the others hidden and say, I'm sorry, this regulation does not apply to us. We have disclosed.
No, so that's actually been the problem that other kinds of disclosure regimes have faced, but ours has this ability which says you have to be able to disclose all the donors, that all the money that's in your organization has to be traced. What happens now is that donors funnel their money through many shell organizations, and the last organization is Small Woodland Animals for Good in the World. And so at the end of the ad, it says this ad was funded by Small Woodland Animals for Good in the World, and you have no idea who the donors are. What this one requires is that if you can't trace all the donors, you can't actually put anything on the ad except for this was paid for by an organization that doesn't disclose its donors.
It makes you wonder if they're not going to disclose, maybe the 501c4 that claims to have the interest of small woodland animals at heart might actually be filled with small woodland animal predators and poisoners and homicidal woodsmen.
It could be, or they're just the Bambi kickers will do the trick.
Now, you live in the real world. Can you imagine that this Congress or any foreseeable Congress could ever pass this as legislation?
Whenever you're talking about whether Congress can do something other than name post offices, you have to be very clear and careful about making the claim. But I'll just say it's more likely to pass this than anything else. We've repeatedly seen efforts to pass a new disclosure regime fail on the Hill, and that's where they're asking to disclose the actual donors, not just something like this. So if you're looking for compromise legislation, this might be it. And it may be especially attractive after 2014 for two reasons. So first, the money game is starting to even out. So when one party dominates the money game, it's always going to do whatever it can to keep the game going. And second, the number of ads that are being funded by dark money is becoming bigger and bigger, and voters are starting to take cognizance of that fact. So this may be a time when there's enough of a controversy for Congress actually to feel the need to do something. And if they're going to do something, this is the easiest something to do.
There are two potential outcomes which I suppose would make you smile. One is that TV viewers who see an ad that is followed by your disclaimer would go, maybe I had to think twice about the content of that ad. And the other outcome is that if voters actually do that, there'll be less incentive to pour money into campaigns to begin with. Either of those is good for you, right?
Right. So, I mean, this is my view is that whenever you're trying to wade into the world of campaign finance, you can't resist politics. You need to harness politics to fix politics. And this does just that. It harnesses political incentives, which is to get your ad to be believed by voters, in order to fix the way the politics is working by funneling money into organizations that do disclose their donors. So I'd rather see this money going into super PACs or parties than going into 501c4s.
One final thing. Smokers have been looking at that cigarettes cause cancer and emphysema and heart disease warning for decades now, and they're still deeply inhaling. Is there an inevitability to this losing what impact it might have?
It's possible in the long term, if we don't fix the dark money problem, that this will. But I think of this as a sort of short-term effort to get bigger and better reform through. So I think that in the short term, what you're going to see is voters will be stunned by how many ads are being paid for by outside groups that don't disclose their donors, and that will start creating at least some energy behind fixing the dark money problem in the first place. So this is, one would hope, the kind of proposal that makes bigger and better reform possible.
Okay, so we're going to put together a fake ad in which some 501c4 says horrible things on the basis of some invention, and then followed by the disclaimer.
It's like a party favor for an interview.
Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Heather Gerken is a professor of law at Yale University.
Tim Vandrapoli once smeared the new Herky the Hawkeye mascot as a little corny. And the career politician's own name is an anagram for Vladimir Putin. Is just another mixed-up Vladimir Putin too radical for Iowa values? Tim Vandrapoli not corny enough for Iowa. This ad was paid for by Americans for Transparency, which does not disclose the identity of its donors.
Ben Bradlee died on Tuesday, and there's little to be said about the legendary Washington Post executive editor that has not been said to a fare thee well all week. In the 1980s, I worked for him as a contract writer, but knew him only slightly, so I've got no intimate anecdote to dine out on. But his passing leaves so much to lament, because we shall not see his like again. Bradlee was of his moment, intrepid ownership, endless resources, and a Vietnam-scarred society prepared to see institutions challenged. And he was also of his post-war expat milieu, arrogant, entitled, macho, and skeptical. That convergence unseated a president. The New York Times' David Carr called Bradlee a patrician pirate. And that nails it. Bradlee took the helm of a nondescript schooner called the Washington Post in 1968 and commenced to plundering. Official deceit, political corruption, simple pomposity, he had his way with them. Even in his custom English dress shirts, he was the dread pirate Bradlee. The schooner became a mighty sailing ship, and Washington and the world quaked. In 1995, 60 Minutes' Mike Wallace asked the then-retired Bradlee about the Buccaneer life.
You miss it?
Yeah, a little bit. I miss the bigs, the stories that take the town by the throat.
You don't hear much about throat-grabbing these days, or mighty vessels, for that matter. There are no more pirates, patrician or otherwise. The last swashbuckler is dead, and everyone else is just bailing, bailing, bailing to stay afloat. Coming up, how a video game website became the unlikely source of advice for pre-adolescent boys about pimples and penises. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. Support for On the Media also comes from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. Subaru, featuring the all-new Subaru Outback. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com. And Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business owners. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of Wonder Woman. Her creator, William Moulton Marston, modeled her on suffragists, Margaret Sanger, the founder of the birth control movement, and erotic pinup art. Sanger's niece was Marston's mistress, with whom he fathered two children. They all lived with Marston and his wife. We'll talk with Jill Lepore about her new Wonder Woman book. Join us.
Weekday mornings at 11 and again at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Though women now represent half the video gaming community, a Pew study this week revealed that gaming is the least welcoming online space for women. That conclusion seems to be borne out by the ongoing troll crusade known as hashtag Gamergate, wherein a small rabble is using a trumped-up scandal as cover for a full-on attack on female game makers and game critics. Until the story materialized in the New York Times last week, one influential gaming publication, called Polygon, did its best not to feed those trolls, but finally weighed in with a letter from the editor, Christopher Grant. Chris, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
Tell me, from your perspective, what is the gate in Gamergate?
A specific situation where an ex-boyfriend published details about a game developer alleged to have slept with a video game journalist. Part of the gate is an erroneous accusation that she slept with him in exchange for a good review, a review that never happened.
but it's all since mutated. And the scandal is no longer about the particulars of this situation, but about the supposed culture wars that are harming the very nature of gaming and its fans.
In reality, it's a rebalancing. Video gaming, on the heels of its 2011 Supreme Court victory, increasing sales, increasing software and tools that make making games open to more people than ever, as it grows into that. I think a lot of people have a lot of concerns about new voices, voices that are oftentimes critical of what's come before entering the fray. It's an old war, right? It's a battle against progressive voices, what they see as political correctness being inserted into a formerly, quote, safe space. It is a culture war.
The kinds of complaints that we have heard about gaming and its occasional misogyny, its sexist characterization of female characters and so forth, we've heard them about the larger popular culture for decades. But there is not a concerted effort to attack and threaten the critics. Why do you suppose that this subculture of gamers has been so, vicious?
It's acceptable to criticize these tropes in film. In film, the Bechdel test, the test being two women having a conversation that isn't about a man, every year, plenty of movies fail that test. Gaming was underanalyzed, right? It was shunned from academia, under-critiqued. But a lot of the criticism that's also been levied against games has been hyperbolic, let's say a bad faith effort. There's no shortage of examples of the mainstream media vilifying games and getting basic facts wrong. So a lot of the gaming audience looked at that criticism and learned a certain way of responding to it, which is that it's wrong, it's ignorant. And then when criticism from inside happens, criticism about the way that women are presented, one example that's very notable here, they deal with it in a sort of hysterical way, in a reactionary way.
Do we even know who the they is?
We know who some of those people are, right? A lot of them are anonymous. Gamergate will be quick to say, well, that's not who we are. It's this logical fallacy where they can define a movement whose inclusion is exactly 10 characters long. All you need to do to be a member of this movement is type the hashtag Gamergate into Twitter. And so they'll reject any behavior that they don't want. Well, you know, basically condoning it and allowing it and boosting it. So it's this very strange, intentionally chaotic mission where they reject, you know, basic order and structure. So as a journalist, it's really hard to tackle it. And the only benefit I can see of being leaderless, of being amorphous, is that they can basically continue their campaign of harassment with little to no culpability.
Is there any public face of Gamergate? Is there anyone who's willing to attach his name to this whole supposed scandal?
Well, there actually is a notable her, Christina Hoff Summers. She's a scholar in residence at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a pretty right-leaning think tank. She has no interest in video games, but she was interested in maybe getting some new converts to her particular ideology. In a lot of cases, the people that are signal boosting this topic don't have anything to do with games. People like Adam Baldwin, who uses his platform on Twitter to sort of amplify a lot of this stuff, you know, he's not a gamer. He doesn't have an interest in this culture. It's a political platform. A lot of the Gamergate adherents are really happy to embrace these opportunists. They call Christine Hoff Summers mom. That's their nickname. So it's a very strange, I don't know, almost like hunger for validation. They do not have a lot of public faces. The ones that they do have, they're very attached to.
You also mentioned that this phenomenon is going to take the reputation of gamers back to where it once was before. Maladjusted guys in their mom's basements with, you know, no other life thanks to the work of these obnoxious vigilantes.
I think it's a very small, almost infinitesimally small percentage of people that play games. They've failed to root out the corruption in games journalism that they insist is there, which after 2 months of a very loud and noisy campaign, they haven't found because it doesn't exist. But what they have done is chase women out of their home. They've made people feel unsafe to speak up. They've made the front page of the New York Times, which even if the author didn't intend it, that sort of mainstream exposure repeats and reinforces a negative stereotype of video gamers that goes back decades. I don't think the stereotypes previously were accurate, and I certainly don't think they're any more accurate now. I think they're, in fact, much less accurate. And it's a stereotype that a lot of people worked really hard to move past. You know, you hear some of the women in the industry speak up about their experiences talking to younger women who are now afraid to join the video game industry because of harassment.
Till now, you've tried to stay out of the fray because you saw no benefit in being in it. But now you are in it. Can I ask you what changed your mind that compelled you to write this letter from the editor? And what do you suppose happens next?
What changed was my willingness to condemn it. And I think as a journalist, I was loath to take this formless, leaderless group and condemn it outright as one that I think is really a front for not only misogyny, but a sort of frustration with progressive voices and progressive ideals. And recognizing that parts of it, the more pernicious parts of it, were getting more brazen, more violent and unchecked, the more negative elements of Gamergate were allowed to, you know, roam the countryside brandishing pitchforks and harassing anyone they could find. And I think the obvious counter to that are reasonable voices. Where it goes from here, I hope, is that they continue to see how fruitless this effort has been. My real hope is that this sort of backlash and this sort of like violent protest will ultimately be remembered as something that was not only hugely ineffective, but that it's also embarrassing, that it's also been a particular low point for our medium and for the culture that surrounds it, and that they have nobody to blame for that but themselves.
Chris, thank you so much.
Bob, thanks so much for having me.
Christopher Grant is editor-in-chief of the online video game publication, Polygon.com. Before he was an OTM producer and co-host of our spin-off podcast, TLDR, PJ Vogt was a gawky teen who, like many others of his kind, sought guidance from a young woman hosting an ad hoc advice column on a video game website. Here's PJ with the story.
In the late 90s, through no real fault of her own, Leah Reich found herself advisor-in-chief to thousands of lonely teenage boys. At the time, Leah wrote for a video game website called IGN, one of the most popular entertainment websites on the internet, if you happen to be a 13 to 18-year-old boy.
There was sci-fi, there was video games. The guy who did Babe of the Day sat next to me. There was all the things that supposedly dudes were into, but it was a very particular kind of dude.
That particular kind of dude was me. A nerd in the last few years before being a nerd really had any kind of social cachet. Remember the scene in Empire Strikes Back where Darth Vader turns Han Solo into a living carbonite statue? You can buy replicas of that statue. They were $6,999. And I used to lie awake at night, literally unable to sleep, fixing about how I could afford one.
The princess, you have to take care of her.
You hear me? Huh?
And for the next 2 years, I read Leah every day. Although in my head, I always pronounced it Leia, like the princess.
I love you.
She'd started out running the site's mailbag column, mostly chatting with readers about new video games or records. But because she was the only woman on the masthead, nervous young boys started asking her nervous young boy questions. She remembers the first one.
Someone said, "You seem really cool, and I don't have anyone else to ask this, so I'm just going to try. And I'm going to ask you about a girl."
Teenagers organized their entire lives around just trying to avoid embarrassment. And IGN was a pretty sarcastic magazine. There's no reason to think that a question like this would go over very well.
And I do remember thinking I could have fun with this letter at the expense of the writer, or I could answer him. Because why not? These are like 14-year-old boys. I mean, they can be little jerks in the worst way and be big jerks in the worst way, but I thought, you know, maybe they cannot be.
Many, many more followed. Some from girls, most from boys. Boys who were gay, boys who were suicidal, boys who were just lonely. For any letters that required medical advice, Leah would go to her mom, who was a doctor, to make sure she got it right. But what made reading Leah so good was that she wasn't an expert. She was just a person who we felt like maybe we could be friends with one day.
Like a 15-year-old who would write and say, "I think I got my girlfriend pregnant, I don't know what to do." And then I would take that opportunity to say, "Okay, so you're 15. You think your girlfriend's pregnant. Here's the thing about sex. Sex is awesome. It's totally great. But like, sex is not just about what you do while you're having sex. Sex is also about feelings. It's about possible repercussions. It's about health. And maybe if you're 15, you need to decide whether you're adult enough to do all of the parts around sex, not just the sex part. And the 15-year-old emailed me after the fact, and he said, you know, we got a test, and we talked to her parents and all this stuff. Turned out she wasn't pregnant, but I thought about everything else you said, and I think you're right. I don't think I'm ready to handle it. So we're going to take a break and not have sex for a while.
Leo was 24 years old, writing for a video game website. The demand for advice was so high that the mailbag column got a new name, Ask Leo. But then the questions overran Ask Leo, so she had to make spinoff columns. Tough Love, which was advice about the heavy stuff, eating disorders or cutting, and What's Up With My Penis, which was exactly what it sounds like. Nervous teenage boys asking about bumps, rashes, whether unorthodox masturbation techniques were causing them irreparable damage. I finally wrote in when I was 14. I was so nervous. I was jumping into this conversation that I'd been eavesdropping on for what felt like forever.
January 5th, 2000. That particular Ask Leah column is called Beauty and the Nerd, Can the Geek Get the Girl? Today's What's Up With My Penis was Remember the Penis is Not Indestructible. And there was a new Tough Love about STD confusion. So it was a really busy time.
And then there was mine.
You actually were trying to help another reader about a problem he was having with his email. You said, not to sound like a nerd or anything, but the thing he said about the problem with his email program, the insert key toggles that feature on and off for your CPU. And then you signed it McFly.
Oh.
But that's fine. You were being helpful. And then I said, hey, thanks. You don't sound like a nerd, but even if you did, no one here would mind.
I remember reading the column and seeing my letter. How scary and exciting that was. Like being called on by a teacher who knows you have the right answer, even though you've been too shy to raise your hand. And that teacher happened to be the coolest girl in the world. In real life, I spent my days at an all-boys school, where the official people in charge of giving us advice about teen issues were gym teachers. About sex, one of them told us that his buddy had broken his penis while having it, and we should be careful not to make the same mistake. About depression, another said that people who slit their wrists were idiots. If you did want to kill yourself, our teacher said, the veins in your thighs are where all the blood is. It just made more sense to listen to Leah.
One of the most memorable things was when a 15-year-old girl wrote me and said, should I get breast implants?
Leah gave the girl advice about how at 15, you don't even know how your body's going to change or how you'll feel about it later. And that was probably a good idea to wait. And then she did something crazy.
I want you guys to write me and tell me what you think. It was a very risky proposition.
Oh, yeah, because it's teenage boys.
Right? But I also felt like it was me saying, I respect that you guys are decent people who are not going to be little jerk-offs. And I want to give all of us this chance to have this conversation because this is about her saying, like, I'm 15, you're all 15. You all seem to think that, like, these women with their big hooters are, like, the end-all be-all. What do I do?
For the most part, the responses were really good.
I mean, they were like, I have a girlfriend and she's pretty flat, but I think she's super, you know, attractive and here's why. The point of loving someone is not that you think they're flawless in every single way, but it's like you love what is attached to them.
Leah had managed to do the impossible, corral a bunch of teenage boys into having a reasonable, mature, thoughtful conversation about boobs.
All right, we're back on our phone line. Leah.
The columns were a big hit for IGN. So Leah was sent on a national publicity tour, which is how she ended up on the Opie and Anthony show.
Are you a lesbian, Leah?
It was literally the worst 72 well. Minutes ever.
All right, so you get a ton of hits. A lot of guys go there for advice.
Yep.
I'm sure you get a lot of weird questions.
I get the best questions on earth.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
It was them having their listeners call in and ask me terrible things.
We have Mike Tyson checking in. I apologize.
Hi, Leah. I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Now, I used to have this problem with Robin Gibbons. The couldn't take a punch.
Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, had walked out of an Opie and Anthony interview the week before.
But, like, he's a movie star, right? I'm Leah. And they have my email address because they've given it out, like, 17 times at this point. And if I walk up in a huff, my inbox will explode and it will be a living nightmare. So I thought I just have to stick it out.
She had a glass jaw. I punch her and she go out like a light.
Oh, that is the worst thing I've ever heard, ever.
The show finally ends and she goes home. And then the emails come.
And all of them started asking for advice. No matter how gross everyone is, no matter how much they all want to laugh at everybody else, when it comes to your own problem, you want someone to take it seriously. That's what it comes down to.
Leah wrote for IGN for 2.5 years, then got laid off in the first internet bust. She went to grad school, and for a long time she didn't miss her life as a sex columnist for young nerds. She'd written nearly 1,500 articles, and how many times can you tell an anonymous 16-year-old that they have acne, not herpes, before you get exhausted? But she misses it now.
I remember one letter that was really great was that a kid wrote me and said, I've never written you for advice, but I've read everything you've written, and I've taken all your advice, and thought a lot about confidence. I've never talked to girls at all. I don't have any girlfriends, but I went up to a girl who I've liked for a long time, and I asked her to homecoming, and I have my very first date ever.
I was thinking that if I'd been 14 in 2014, maybe if I'd looked for advice about girls or sex, I would have found men's rights activists or stumbled into like a Tumblr discussion of social justice stuff. And you should not have been such a good, like, it shouldn't have been there. It feels very lucky.
I feel lucky, and I also feel sad that I don't know how to replicate it or bring it back. I mean, I got a lot of stupid letters from a lot of little jerks that were like, you're ugly, you're dumb. You know, I mean, of course I got little trolley emails. I mean, the internet has always and will always be the internet. And 14-year-old boys are never going to change. But I feel like it was a moment and a time where there wasn't so much out there that was clamoring for everyone's attention. I think one of the things that it also tells me is that there are places for quieter voices. Not that, like, I was always quiet. I mean, I was funny, and we had fun, and we joked around. But that we can talk about stuff. We will take some hard lines when we have to, but that's not the role of this. And I helped some guy get a date to homecoming.
Former OTM producer PJ Vogt reported that story for our excellent spin-off podcast, TLDR. If you go to onthemedia.org or subscribe to TLDR on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from, you will find 36 other episodes just as good as the one you just heard. And in the spirit of the times, I want to encourage you to go ahead and binge the bejesus out of that podcast. 37 in a row. Go crazy. If there's anything you want. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimi Regler, Mira Sharma, and Andrew Chubb.